The title of what I want to share tonight is the Cyanide Flats. Now, that don't mean much to you yet, but I hope you know when I'm done what I'm referring to. I told you all the other night that my wife was born and raised in the Red Lake, Ontario area. Her father is 90 years old. He still lives there. And I spent 7 years in that area myself. Some of you have probably been there, some of you older ones. Red Lake, Ontario was founded in 1926 from a gold rush. And there's a vast area of land that lies between the fertile lands of southern Ontario and the flat and seemingly endless prairies of Manitoba, west to the Canadian Rockies on British Columbia, Alberta border. It's known as the Canadian Shield. It's a rugged land of lakes and forests, giant rock outcroppings with only a few small areas that are suitable for farming. And one of those is New Liskeard, in Ontario-Quebec border, about 500 miles north of Kitchener-Waterloo area. Then there's Cochrane, Ontario, and it has a few dairies and some cattle, but that country is not for the faint-hearted. There's some open pockets of land near Dryden, Ontario, where the Swiss have settled and dairy farm as well. They are well suited for the cold and harsh climate. Yes, Mennonites have settled into all those places, and someone has said that Mennonites are always looking for better land. And I used to tease my dad and my Uncle Howard Brubaker that they can't accuse them of that when they move to our community. Compared to other regions where people have settled and where farming thrives in Western Canada, Red Lake is not really all that far north. It's 300 miles north of International Falls, Minnesota. But the polar jet streams come down to Hudson Bay and dump Arctic masses of air onto that part of North America and keeps the growing season very short, the winters very long and very cold. I have seen snow there every month of the year in Sandy Lake, Ontario, and I have been very cold as well. Until the early 1920s, only Native First Nations peoples lived in that area as a nomadic people of hunters, trappers, and fishing. They grew very little food. Flour and other staples were brought in either by canoe or dog teams. Very slow and very hard work. In 1925, prospectors pushed north by dog teams and early open cockpit airplanes into what is now called Red Lake, Ontario. Gold was discovered there, and when news of that discovery was printed in the newspapers, in the big cities, over 5,000 people swarmed into that rugged and desolate area, and there was over 18,000 claims registered at the mining office in Kenora, Ontario that first year. Now, unlike the placer gold of the Klondike or California gold rushes, Red Lake is known to be as lode gold. Lode gold is a deposit of gold in a solid rock. And it meant that prospectors were looking for geographical features like quartz veins rather than gold nuggets in streams and rivers. And as most always is the case, few win big, and most of those would-be rich, quick prospectors went bust. There have been two more significant gold rushes in Red Lake since the early 1920s. In 1944, a vein was discovered that produced up to 9 ounces of gold per ton of rock. And I think a cubic square yard of stone or sand weighs about 2.5 tons, depending. And so we're talking a ton. That's not that much. And they get 9 ounces of gold from a ton of rock. And that mine is still in existence today. And in the late 1990s, another mine was developed there in the edge of Red Lake. And as of July of 2020, over 30 million ounces, or 9,375 tons of high-quality gold have been mined in the Red Lake area. Red Lake has the richest ore deposits in Canada, maybe in all the world. The Red Lake mine is 8,200 feet below the surface. They have to pump cold air down there because it's deep enough, close enough to the center of the earth, that it gets hot. And so they have to run air conditioners and pump cold air down for the miners. I have two pictures that I'm going to just pass around so you can see what some of the Red Lake ore looks like. I thought I had a figure here of how much the value of that gold was, but I don't see it. The actual and extraction and refining process of gold has changed from ancient times until now. In biblical times, gold-bearing rock was beaten and crushed by hammers until it was in small enough pieces or almost like powder to expose most of the gold, and then the gold ore was heated at temperatures where the gold would melt out of the rocks and be collected, and then they heated it again in a different cat ore pot to burn the impurities out of it. And so we have that spiritual connection in 1 Peter 1, verse 7. These have come so that your faith of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire, may be proven genuine and may result in praise and glory and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed. In 1817, there was a Scotchman named John Stuart MacArthur, and he figured out this system that if you would take gold ore and crush it a bit and then soak it in cyanide, the cyanide would eat up all the rock and just leave you with the gold, because gold is not affected by acids. And so you can extract over 96% of the gold out of ore with this cyanide soaking process. And so by the late 1800s, 1890s, this process has become the gold standard for extraction and is used almost exclusively in the United States and Canada in the mining process. Now, cyanide comes in several formulations depending on the particular use and purpose of the end product. All of the formulations are very poisonous and toxic, but there's no evidence that it is known as a carcinogen. Wherever there's a mining town, especially those where they mine gold, there is usually a body of water there where the cyanide solution was run into. And now they build big holding ponds and they're lined with impervious liners, leak-proof, where they put their solution in so that it doesn't run out into the local water systems. In times past, cyanide residue often found its way into a local stream and then a lake, and it has become barren and wasteland, an environmental nightmare by today's standards. And so I used to fly, and if you'd be flying across the north, it's trees and water, but then you come to a spot and it's just nothing but raw dirt. You look close, and there's some old mine buildings down there falling down. No, they're not. But the dirt is sterile. It's ruined. Red Lake is located at the end of the road, 100 miles north of the Trans-Canada Highway. It's about a two-hour drive through mostly untouched Canadian bush of lakes, poplar, spruce, jack pine, and muskeg. And then you arrive into the suburbs of Red Lake, a small town of less than 2,000 people. As you arrive, you will notice a lake just on the edge of town that looks like somewhat normal, except for a huge area that I'm sure many think is a large sandy beach. There's no vegetation. All that's missing is the palm trees. That lake was actually the tailings pit for some of the mines in the 1920s and 40s. Almost 100 years later, nothing grows on that end of the lake where the tailings were dumped. When I arrived in Red Lake in the middle 1970s, it still looked like a beach, but most of the lake was starting to look normal otherwise. Tree-lined shores and crystal blue water. My wife Grace and her siblings used to swim at the Cyanide Flats. That was the name of that nice, beautiful beach. No trees, no grass, just sand and blue water. Grace seems no worse for it, but her little sister died from bone cancer at the tender age of 16. But my research has found that while it is a very toxic to drink, it is not known to cause cancer. I mentioned that before. Now, the water in that lake at the Cyanide Flats is not pure and pristine looking for no reason. There is no life there. At least that was what we were told. No moss, no algae, no leeches, no minnows, so no food chain, of course, no big fish. However, Steve Stolzfus, Dan Kurtz, and Myron Mullett were in service with me. And one evening, we decided to see just maybe after 50 years if something may have decided to live where there was little or no competition. So we borrowed a boat, got a fishing rod and a big red and white spoon, and we launched into Red Lake and portaged around and got into the Cyanide Flats. When we launched into the healthy looking inn and began trolling, eventually, Steve said that he had a snag and that I should reverse the motor to see if he could get off whatever was hanging onto his spoon. And then the snag started to move just a little bit. Not much, but enough to know that there was either a giant turtle or the Loch Ness Monster had taken his lure. Steve eventually landed a trophy northern pike or jackfish, probably 40 inches or more. Pretty much a wall hanger. And I don't remember if he had it mounted or not, but I just remember that we didn't eat that fish. It might be full of cyanide residue and poisonous, so we thought. So what do the scriptures tell us about the living water? 1 Timothy 1, 3, and 5, let me read that. As I urged you when I went to Macedonia, stay there in Ephesus so that you may command certain men not to teach false doctrines any longer, nor to devote themselves to myths and endless genealogies. These promote controversies rather than God's work, which is by faith. The goal of this command is to love, which comes from a pure heart, and a good conscience, and a sincere faith. Some have wandered away from these and turned to meaningless talk. They want to be teachers of the law, but they don't know what they're talking about, or what they are so confidently affirm. We know that the law is good if one uses it properly. We also know that the law was not made for the righteous, but for the lawbreaker and rebels, the ungodly and sinful, the unholy and irreligious, and for those who kill their fathers or mothers, for murderers, for adulterers, perverts, for slave traders, liars and perjurers, and for whatever else is contrary to sound doctrine, that confirms to the glorious gospel of the blessed God, which he entrusted to me. Someone has said this: no one gives advice with more authority and enthusiasm than the uninformed. And it's often the way it is. Somebody that has so much to say with so much authority, but they haven't studied their lesson or done the homework. And this is what Paul is talking about. These do-good preachers that really don't live close and are not led by the Spirit of God. It's been an age-old problem for self-serving or those wanting to enlighten the faithful with some new way of teaching, thus contaminating the purity of the gospel. And the story just becomes muddled and cloudy very quickly. Beware of those who will gladly serve you clear, cold, refreshing water. Spiritual-looking water, but along with it is a stout dose of cyanide of false doctrine. When I was in service, there was a young man that I lived, and we were really good friends, but he had kind of wandered off onto the left side of the Anabaptist movement, and he was promoting that I read the New Wine magazine. Have you all ever heard of the magazine New Wine? Kind of had a Pentecostal bent, and it was real popular in the 1970s and 80s. And I looked at a few of these magazines, and I said, bro, there isn't any new wine. It's all right here. And I still think that today. There's no new wine. From the opening sentence to the closing phrase, this glorious gospel of the blessed God, Paul is reviewing that with Timothy that the gospel really is. Here we have in these verses the smooth blending of doctrine and behavior. The gospel is not only a way of thinking, it's a way of living. And it always involves both doctrine and practice. One of the things that Paul mentions is that scriptures are profitable for doctrine and teaching. Good doctrine is so important. It determines how we think and view the issues of life. And that is so crucial. Because if you do not think correctly, you will not live correctly. And what we believe will and does determine our conduct towards God and others. Part of the problem is our insatiable appetite for the new and the different. We want the new wine. We're tired of... I could tell you a story, but I'll keep moving. Somehow we want the new wine. There will always be a following of loyal obedience for teachers who develop clever variations of the gospel. But the bottom line should always be godly edification, not getting a following. Remember, bad doctrine almost always leads us away or to be okay with sloppy living. Protestantism or Calvinism, just to name a few, will convince you of a false assurance of your eternal destiny. Some of you are my age and older. Does the name Jim Jones sound familiar? Jim, you all are a gray-haired, I mean. Oh. You young fellas, do you know Jim Jones? You want me to tell you about Jim Jones? In the mid-1960s, a former Methodist minister who started a church predominantly among African Americans in California and was eventually ordained in the Assemblies of God Church, a mainline Pentecostal denomination that soon morphed into a cult as a faith healer and man worship him. He became an active member of the local Communist Party and idolized Adolf Hitler. The U.S. government became suspicious of his cult and started to investigate him. And so Mr. Jones's church, you know, there was a lot of hippies and young people that really got sucked into his pie-in-the-sky theology and socialism. And so the local government was looking for these teenagers and these people that got into this cult. Well, Jim Jones started to feel the heat, and he knew that the government was watching him, was looking after him, and so he moved all of his assets and all the members of his cult into the deep jungles of Guyana. Now, young fella, are you finished with school? And you took world geography? Well, maybe you didn't need to. Where's Guyana? Where is Guyana, Kevin?
Is it South America?
Is it? Anyone?
It is, yeah, it is.
Okay. It's on the northeast coast of South America. So he moved his all of his hippies and young people and all of his stuff. He left California and went to Guyana. Well, a U.S. senator from California and some of his staffers flew to the compound to look and see if any of these young people were disillusioned with this guy. He took their money. He took everything, and they worshiped him. Whatever he said was the gospel, according to Jim Jones. And when he landed, some of the people from the cult shot him and his entourage there at the airport. Well, November the 18th, 1978, Jones figured that the government would come and investigate and arrest him, so he mixed cyanide into a purple drink. And it wasn't actually Kool-Aid. But you've heard the expression, he drank the Kool-Aid. That's where that comes from. The Kool-Aid people weren't happy with that, and they tried to get it stopped. But now, since the late 70s, when you refer to somebody as drinking the Kool-Aid, that means they got hoodooed, right? Okay. So he had those people practice to drink this stuff. And one day he mixed the cyanide in with it. And that day, the parents gave it to their children. And then the parents and other adults drank it. And Jones had his girlfriend shoot him, and then she shot herself. That day, 918 souls died. 304 of them were children. There's a spiritual parallel to that. Revelation 20, verse 12. And I saw the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne, and the books were opened. And another book was opened, which was the book of life. And the dead were judged according to what they had done, as recorded in the books. And the sea gave up its dead, as it were, and death and Hades gave up the dead that were in them. And each person was judged according to what he had done. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire, and the lake of fire is the second death. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. And then chapter 21, verse 6, and he said unto me, it is done. I am the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. To him who is thirsty, I will give to him drink without cost from a spring of water of life. And he who comes will inherit all of this. And I will be his God, and he will be my son. But the cowardly, the unbelieving, the vile, the murderers, the sexually immoral, those who practice magic arts, the idolaters and all liars, their place will be in the fiery lake of burning sulfur. And this is the second death. Isn't it wonderful that we can read in those same verses that we can drink without cost from the spring of the water of life? I think I told y'all that I was born in the Shenandoah Valley, Virginia, and lived there until I was 16. On the farm where we lived in Virginia was a spring in the woods by one of our fields. And when me and my brothers, each summer and each fall, we had to pick rocks out of the field. And we would often go over in the woods beside the field and lay on our stomachs and drink of that very cold, refreshing water as it bubbled up under the ground, under the roots of a big tree. We drank from the spring of the water of life, as mentioned in Revelation 21:6, like I just read. There was never a hint of cyanide or false erroneous teaching in that spring, what is now on my cousin Samuel Gehring's farm. But cousin Samuel's in the dairy business. He's in the dairy business in a big way, and he's got two big concrete holding tanks, big things, bigger than this church, where he stores all the muck and waste from his dairy. And I'm sure that if you would ask him, he would grant you the privilege to drink from that vast reservoir. But me, I'll take that bubbling spring, the water of life, 1,000 yards away over under that big tree in the edge of the field that I remember as a boy. I called Sam one night not too long ago and asked him, is that spring still bubbling, clear, cold, cyanide-free water? And he assured me that it was. This evening, I want to plead with you. Beware of books, podcasts, video clips, or publications written by those whose faith and practice and application is weak at best, or is obviously not applying the whole truth of the scripture. Remember, we are never more spiritual than we are scriptural. It is a grave and serious responsibility for those who are given the responsibility of teaching to neglect about maintaining the purity of the gospel. And that's not just for church leaders, but also for fathers and mothers as you teach and train your children to grow up, to be faithful in their generation, to be pillars in the church. 1 Corinthians 9:16. For though I preach the gospel, I have nothing to glory of, for necessity is laid upon me. Yea, woe is me if I preach not the gospel. I want to talk a little bit about cyanide and the Anabaptist movie culture. You know, a guy can choose to look at pornography and have thoughts and emotions awakened that were not meant to be aroused or enjoy outside of marriage. But sad to say, many do. A girl can just as easily be turned to romance novels, movies, and music, which can be found instantly on YouTube and online. To a woman, this is pornography. both visual and emotional. It fills her heart with thoughts, desires, and longings that cannot be fulfilled in a godly way. It sets expectations in her heart for a relationship that could never be that perfect. And she can easily feed her emotions on desires by watching a couple enjoy each other, being intimate, feeling cherished, even though the couple is 100% play-acting. This only sows discontent and awakens desire within a girl before God opens that door. And so I ask you, is it okay for your mama to go to work making Christian movies and schlecking? That's the only Dutch word I know. To lick or something? That's what my wife told me. And hugging up on some dude that is not her husband, then come home, cook supper, help the children with their homework, and then go off to bed with your dad. Somehow I have a problem with that. Romans 1:32. Although they know God's righteous decree that those who do such things deserve death, they not only continue to do these very things, but also approve of those who practice them. I want to suggest that when we enjoy watching other people sin, we become partakers of that sin with them. Be careful what you bless and what you condone. We don't let violent people in our house on purpose, and we don't bring immoral and those kind of people into our homes. But yet, through the media, and people bring stuff into their homes and sit down and watch it with their families, and I'm like, it's the same. You just as well invite them in. God has given each of us a healthy imagination. We must take every thought captive to Jesus Christ, 2 Corinthians 10:4. The world today has sexualized most everything, and it's only getting worse. And as God's people today, we must guard our eyes and ears and hearts almost everywhere we go. And it's the saddest when we have to guard them at our own church functions. In 2026, it is almost impossible to find media that does not involve profanity, immorality, sensuality, sexuality, or violence. And to top it all off, most of the sexuality that isn't in the movies isn't between a husband and a wife. I mentioned that above. Movies are so destructive to a mind that desires to be content, selfless, righteous, and pure. So why would we bring the immoral and immodesty that we spiritually fight against in the world into our homes, bedrooms, and friendships through media and movies? I taught Bible school, a Bible school in North Georgia, and every term we had, they had an evangelist come. And every year, almost it seemed, they would get up to preach and they would turn towards the guys and they would talk about filthiness of mind and thought, and the girls got off scot-free. I got tired of it because I taught those girls and I knew they struggled with their reading and their movies, and they would go to the beach and watch guys and talk about these hunks and these ripped bods, and that, you know what I'm talking about. It's not just a guy thing, it's a human thing. I cannot say that 100% of movie culture is evil, but so much of it is. Anything your heart desires can be found on YouTube, the internet, or by downloading and watching a movie. Why play with fire? I believe that every day the devil tempts hearts and leads them astray through YouTube and other media outlets like Netflix and other online movie streaming services. You can be innocently searching for something wholesome and innocently and be tempted with 20 other picture options for a quick sinful things to watch. YouTube is really helpful. They got all kinds of tutorials, and if you want to know how to fix the motor in your Ford pickup. Well, there's a YouTube tutorial. But there's a lot there that they're offering you that you've really got to be careful. And a lot of the things that people download do not bring honor and glory to God. Media is not the only struggle for all of us. It tends to be overlooked and misunderstood that women can be visual too. A man may dress, the way a man dresses shows much about his heart, just as the attire of a woman can show the intention of her heart. If you have not thought about it before, please think about it now. As a young man, are you trying to keep your body a secret as much as you expect that of young ladies? Men cannot dismiss the fact that women can identify with their struggle because they have been told that the primary gate for sexual stimulation is non-visual. That's not so. Men, you must be sensitive about your appearance too, your dress and conduct. And women cannot overlook men's struggle. We must remember that modesty in dress and conduct and speech, the things that we feed on for our spiritual man. Men must realize that women have lust, desire, struggles too. Most women are visual. Don't fool yourself. It has been preached far too long that it's just a guy thing. That's simply not true. A young lady will have a deeper respect for a guy if she has witnessed him guarding his eyes. I had a couple work for me that were not Mennonite people, but they were from the West Coast. They were devout Christians in another denomination. And one day, the man that, from Select Sires, a bull stud in Ohio, was there. He was looking at some heifers to see about buying some heifers. And this couple was along, and she had to cross a fence. And so she went to go through the fence, and this man turned and looked the other way. And then when we came back, when she went to cross and crawl through the fence, he turned and looked the other way. And this guy was just a salesman. He didn't profess to be anything, I don't think. But this lady says, that would never happen in Washington State. All men would try to be sneaking a peep. She was so impressed. Well, that's not going to get that man to heaven, but at least he was taught, and at least he was respectful to women. Remember, most of media comes through the eye gate and is the devil's workshop. Lust is sin. It may be very common, but does not make it okay. Just because our peers or church leaders don't know it doesn't make it okay. God sees, He knows, He cares. He is a just God and will judge our thoughts and actions and motives. God desires to see us walk in victory, and He will help us. Sexual intimacy is a beautiful thing designed by God, but only in the confines of marriage. And ever since the Garden of Eden, the devil has been hard at work trying to pervert it and make it shameful and dirty. I personally am not a big fan of movies in general. I can and have enjoyed an educational documentary, but again, with discretion. I do not have time to watch movies, and I would hope that I would not watch movies if I did have time. So why do people watch movies? Why do conservative Christian Anabaptist people seem so addicted to movies? Now, maybe it's not a problem with you, but I just taught Bible school, and I taught young people at IGO, and I know what I'm talking about. A movie is not just a movie. It's a method of shaping society and your worldview. It provides thought processes and behaviors that blurs the distinction between real life and the imaginary and make-believe experiences. It creates a false desire of reality. It replaces God in the decision-making process. A culture of movie watching has developed among young Anabaptist people. And meanwhile, movies are shaping and impacting their young lives and ways of the world. Watching movies has become a way to take a break from life and allow the screen, both large and small, to present its version of life. It allows the watcher to disengage from life's daily difficulties and allows us to experience a wide range of experiences and emotions. And it meets people at all levels of arousal, and it engages them in sinful emotional images that burn into our minds, and those images create a separate reality in our mind. And I want to list a couple things of why I think it's best that we not foster a habit of watching movies. Watching movies will cause a lack of spiritual discernment, a lack of discretion, an acceptance of immodesty, of immorality, violence, vile behaviors, vile language. Sin can become normal. And that is a high price to pay for an hour of escape from the stresses and realities of life. Among my objections to movies is that God's name is frequently used in vile ways. How can a Christian sit there and allow the name of God to be used as a curse word? A Christian cannot do that. The liberal, worldly agenda that has been attacking the foundations of society for many years is often expressed in movies. Love stories, mysteries, thrillers of all sight that captivate the eye and mind. Many millions and millions of dollars are invested into the production, and misinformation is fed into young lives. Behaviors and appearances of men and women are paraded before our eyes, and cool talk and the cliches of the younger generation. Are there not some good movies? Certainly. They are not all in the same category, but user discretion is critical, and it is not always present. Little by little, the movie watching habit grows, and until discernment is dulled and discretion is numb to sin, and wisdom will eliminate the sin from your life. Eliminate. Movies create an unchristian worldview. It's not just a movie. Hollywood knows the power of images, and movies not only represent but shape society, and they will shape your and my life also. Do you want your life shaped by Hollywood or by God and His Word? It is your choice, but you cannot have it both ways. Psalm 101:3, I will set no evil thing before my eyes. Probably all of us who can read are familiar with the story of Jesus and the Samaritan woman at Jacob's well. And I want to read that at this time. And there cometh a woman of Samaria to draw water. And Jesus saith unto her, give me a drink. For his disciples were going away into the city to buy meat. Then saith the woman of Samaria unto him, how is it that thou, being a Jew, askest a drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. And Jesus answered and said unto her, if thou knowest the gift of God, and who it is that saith unto thee, give me a drink, thou wouldest ask him, and he would have given thee life-giving water. And the woman said unto him, sir, thou hast nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. From whence then hast thou that living water? Art thou greater than our father Jacob, that gave us this well and drank thereof, him and his children and his cattle? And Jesus answered and said unto her, Whosoever drinketh of this water shall thirst again, but whosoever shall drink of the water that I give them shall never thirst. But the water that I shall give him is from a well of water springing up into everlasting life. And the woman saith unto him, Sir, give me this water, that I thirst not, and neither come hither to draw. These verses confirm that Jesus and Jesus alone is our source of our spiritual water, not Islam, not Buddha, nor all the sacred cows of India. Acts 4:12. Salvation is found in no one else. There is no other name under heaven given to men which we must be saved. You can be very sure that any other way that men may teach or believe is a possible way to eternal life is nothing more than cyanide-laced water, not the spiritual water that quenches thirst forever. A time is coming when there will not be life-giving water for all. There will be those who long for it and beg and plead for just a few drops, but that opportunity to enjoy cool, refreshing springs will be gone forever. You know this story, Luke 16:19. And there was a rich man who dressed in purple and fine linen, and he lived in luxury every day, and at his gate laid a beggar named Lazarus covered with sores, and he longed to eat what fell from the rich man's table. And even the dogs came and licked up his sores. The time came when the beggar died, and the angels carried him to Abraham's side. And the rich man also died and was buried. And in hell, where he was in torment, he looked up and he saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. So he called to him, Father Abraham, have pity on me and send Lazarus to dip his finger in the water and cool my tongue, because I am in agony in this fire. But Abraham replied, Son, remember that in your life you received your good things while Lazarus received bad things. But now he is comforted here and you're in agony. And besides all this, between us and you is a great chasm fixed, so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross from there to us. And he answered, Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my father's house, for I have five brothers, and let him warn them so that they will also not come to this place of torment. And Abraham replied, Well, they have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them. No, Father Abraham, he said, but if someone from the dead goes unto them, they will repent. And he said unto them, If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced, even if someone raises from the dead. Several years ago, Grace and I went to see one of our sons in Nicaragua, and they live on the southwest coast. And you think it gets hot here? Well, it really gets hot there. And so in February is their dry season, and the sun beats down day after day. And that part of Nicaragua is referred to as the dry coast. The heat is brutal. It's very brown and very hot and very windy and dry and dusty. And sitting in church on Sunday morning, my mind was not drawn to the message. I'm just going to be honest. I don't understand Spanish. But my mind wandered, and I kept seeing this tall glass bottle of Coca-Cola with beads of sweat running down the side of the bottle and making a little puddle there on the table. And there was these fuzzy little bubbles dancing up the neck of the bottle and collecting in a small ring of foam at the top of the soda as they sizzled and danced and sparkled their way up into thin air. I was so thirsty. Rest assured, there will be no cold sodas in hell, and there will be no water either. 2 Corinthians 6:2, for he saith, I have heard thee in a time accepted. The day of salvation have I succored or favored thee. Behold, now is the accepted time. Behold, now is the day of salvation. No one is forced to yield or live for God while we live in what we call today. But the scriptures are full of invitations calling us to Christ and the life of life-giving water. John 7:37, and Jesus stood and said in a loud voice, if anyone is thirsty, let him come unto me and drink. And whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, streams of living water will flow from within him. Revelation 22:17, and the Spirit and the bride say, come. And let him who hears say, come. And whoever is thirsty, let him come. And whoever wishes, let him take the free gift of the water of life. Calvin Coolidge was the presiding over the Senate before he was the president. And one senator angrily hollered at another, and you'd have thought that only politics had went down the tube recently, but evidently it's a tradition with politics. And this angry senator hollered at the other one and told him to go straight to hell. And the offended senator complained to him as the presiding officer, and Mr. Coolidge looked up from the book that he had been leafing through while listening to the debate. I've been looking through the rule book, he said. You don't have to go. And I'm here this evening to tell you that you don't have to go there either. But if you insist on drinking from springs other than from the living water that Jesus gives, you have made your own choice. Remember, we are free to make our choices. But we are not free from the consequences of those choices. Every day, people are dying who have never died before. And every day, people are dying who did not expect to die so soon. One time, my wife and I were going up to Red Lake, Ontario to see her mother. She was ill with cancer, and the way it worked out, we were going to spend Sunday at Traverse City, Michigan with some people we knew. And so on the way, we decided to go through Detroit, which is not the normal way we would go, because her brother lives in London, Ontario, and you go to Detroit and then go over into Ontario a little ways. And so we wanted to visit her brother. But we had some extra time. And someone had told us that the Henry Ford Museum was worth our time to see. And so we went to the Henry Ford Museum. We got there at 8 o'clock in the morning. And that way we could do the tour and get on our way up to Traverse City. Well, when we got there, there was some people milling around, but there wasn't a lot of activity. And you could go into the lobby, and there were the ticket booths, but it said the gates were closed, and it said opens at 9. And what I noticed was that people were walking up and down those great, long, big halls. This elderly guy came up to us, and he says, well, did you all come to see the museum? And I said, yes, sir, we did. He said, well, it don't open till 9, and I just come in here in the morning to do my walk. And I tell you what, if you meet me right there at 9 o'clock, I will get you in. You do not need a ticket because I know Henry Ford. I used to work for Henry Ford, and he gave me a lifelong pass, and I'll get you in. Well, I didn't know if he had dementia or Alzheimer's or what, but away he went. Went back down the hall. And so at about 5 minutes to nine, Grace and I came back and stood over there where he told us to. And the people were rolling in the doors and lining up to get their tickets. And, well, if we needed a ticket, we was going to sure be at the back of the line. And here he come round the corner, a smile as big as Texas. And he said, "Follow me." And so we went down this long hall for a ways, and then we turned right and went up this other hall, and we got to this door. And beside this door was a big oak roll-top desk. I don't know if it was Henry Ford's or not, but there sat this lady with a scowl on her face, and it looked like sugar wouldn't melt in her mouth. And we walked up to her, and he said, "There with me. Let them in." And we stuck out our hands, and she stamped them with an ink mark, and she let us in, and he turned around and left. I didn't know Henry Ford. I didn't have any reason to be there. I hadn't bought a ticket, but that man paid the price for my wife and I that day. We were with him. And he knew the Father. He knew Henry Ford. And so this evening, are you with Jesus? When you get to the pearly gates, when you cross the river, will Jesus say, "Let him in. He's with me"? Shall we pray?